Our beloved master, Shoudei, who was born in 738 in China and died in 820, was a disciple of Sakito. Shoudei stayed at Mount Nangaku under Sakito for 3 years, then went to Mount Shuko, where he saw Matsu. Matsu asked, "What did you come here for?" Shoudei said, "I came here for Buddha's Janma Darshana." Matsu said, "Buddha has no Janma Darshana. Janma Darshana is the world of delusion. You are from Mount Nangaku, but it seems that you have not yet known that you need Sakito, so you should go back." Hearing that, Shoudei went to Sakito. On meeting the master, Shoudei asked Sakito, "What is Buddha?" Sakito replied, "There is no Buddha nature in you." Shoudei asked, "What about all living beings?" Sakito replied, "They have Buddha nature." Shoudei asked, "Why don't I have it?" Sakito said, "Because you don't accept it." At this, Shoudei decided to stay there. Later, he lived in the Shodaiji temple and did not go outdoors for 30 years. Whenever a seeker came to him, he would say, "Go away. You don't have Buddha nature."
A famous psychoanalyst, Franz Strunz, from Munich, has been studying child behavior in the dreams, and he has found that Sigmund Freud's original idea was not right. Sigmund Freud's original idea was that the child, every child, particularly in the civilized and cultured world, lives under repressive morality, repressive priesthood, repressive parents, and he cannot understand exactly why his natural and spontaneous behavior is unacceptable. He is not yet grown up in the mind. The mind will come slowly. But he has born as a natural being. So he finds it absolutely difficult to understand that why his natural behavior is condemned. But because he has to be dependent on the parents and he is utterly helpless, he has to accept the God that the parents believe in, and he has to accept all the commandments in which the parents believe, and they drive the child to the church or to whatever religious organization they belong. This is the beginning of programming the child. Sigmund Freud's original thesis was that under these circumstances, the child finds only freedom in his dreams. The parents are no more there, the priest is no more there, the god is no more there. No morality, no condemnation, no repression, no inhibition. In his dreams, he lives a very natural and very pleasant life. That becomes a substitute for him. And I am absolutely in agreement with Sigmund Freud. The child does not know yet what is dream and what is real. It takes a little time. That's why you cannot remember. If you go backwards, up to the age 4, you may be able to remember few things. Beyond that is complete blank. But things were happening. Since your birth, up to the age 4, things were happening, but you don't have any memory. Because you did not have yet the mind. The mind is a social product. It takes at least 4 years to program the child to be ready to accept anything that is told to him. Because he knows if he denies it, he will suffer punishment. Not only here, but in hellfire. But in his dreams, up to the age 4, he enjoys absolute freedom. Hence, Sigmund Freud said that the children's dreams are very pleasant, very beautiful. In fact, the child can cope with the reality only because of his dreams. The dreams are compensatory. But this man, Franz Strunz, has been surveying hundreds of children and their dreams. His conclusion is that Sigmund Freud was wrong. So first I have to give you his statement. Sigmund Freud's views on child dreams have been challenged by Munich psychologist Franz Strunz. Sigmund Freud claimed that children's dreams reveal the pleasure-oriented nature of nocturnal figments of an imagination, which was not hampered by the suppression and repression of the adult emotional makeup, and which aimed at making secret wishes come true. Obviously, dreams are very private. Nobody can enter in your dreams. And nobody can know what you are dreaming. The child has absolute freedom. But he is not free when he is awake. Naturally, he compensates whatever has been denied in his waking life. He fulfills those wishes in his dream. And because he cannot make the distinction that the dream is just a dream and the reality is a totally different matter, he is completely happy. And he can tolerate this society and this repressive culture and these unnatural demands made by religions, their god, their priests, just because he has a freedom at least when he is asleep. This has been challenged by this Munich psychologist. His research showed that children's nocturnal fantasies are mainly accompanied by stifling feelings of uneasiness and upset, and that all kinds of threat animals, thieves, robbers, murderers, catastrophes, death, and frightening strangers greatly disturb sleeping children. Most children, he said, are paralyzed with fear by the dangers they dream about. I absolutely disagree with this Munich psychoanalyst. In a hurry to criticize Sigmund Freud, he has forgotten that Sigmund Freud was surveying the dreams of totally different children. A great thing has happened in between that he has not taken note of. That is television. It is television that has changed the children's dreams. What the god could not do, what the priest could not do, what the parents could not do, because they used alphabetical language, logic, which the child was not yet capable to understand. The child lives in a primitive way. Pictures he can understand. His language is pictorial. His dreams are very vivid and very colorful, very alive. Television has created a great impact on children, on their behavior, on their dreams, because the dreams and the television look alike. Now the child cannot make the difference between the television and the dreams. And on the television he is seeing all these things that this Munich psychologist is trying to use as a criticism of Sigmund Freud's fundamental hypothesis. Stifling feelings of uneasiness and upset, and that all kinds of threat animals, thieves, robbers, murderers, catastrophes, death, and frightening strangers greatly disturb sleeping children. All this is the gift of television. It has nothing to do with Sigmund Freud's fundamental hypothesis. It is still right. But this is how even your psychologists, world-famous people, behave unconsciously. He has completely forgotten that a new thing has happened between him and Sigmund Freud, and that is television. And it has changed the children's not only dreams, but his behavior too. He sees all kinds of robberies, rapes, murders, thieves, all kinds of dangerous people on the television. Those are pictorial. The sermons of the priest were not pictorial, they were linguistic. His parents' teachings were linguistic, and he was not yet able to understand language and logic, but pictures he understands. So television has given all kinds of threatening, sensational, dangerous ideas to the children's minds. It is television that should have been noted by the psychoanalyst. But rather than focusing on television, he has immediately gone to criticize Sigmund Freud. I am taking it to give you a sense that even your psychoanalysts, psychiatrists, psychologists are as unconscious people as anybody else. There is no difference. Not only the dreams have changed, even the behavior of children. In America, even small children, just few days before, one child randomly went into the school with the gun of his father and killed 4 children. And it was not that they were enemies or anything, just random. He just fired because he has been seeing on the television continuous killing, murder, a great excitement. And it is not an exceptional case. Children have been found trying to rape small girls. The idea is being given by the television. Children of the age of 7 and 8 are taking drugs. They have left hippies far behind. At least to be a hippie, you used to be 18, 19, 20. The hippiedom exists only from 20 to 30. After 30, the hippie disappears. In his place comes yuppie. By the time he is 30, he starts understanding that this way of life is not going to last long. Now their parents are refusing to support. And the hippie has to change into a square world. He has to go back to the same society, clean shaved, well dressed, looking very professional and efficient. And yuppies have proved that they are capable of doing things. Now they have their homes, their cars, their wives, their children, and nobody can think that these people used to walk around the streets dirty, unclean. Uncleanliness has become their philosophy. It was a reaction because parents were telling to them that cleanliness is just next to God. And they have heard the news that God is dead. Now who is next to God? Cleanliness? The reaction was against the parents and their constant effort to repress their nature. They started moving to the extreme, other extreme. They started having a philosophy of uncleanliness, dirtiness. But then they became dropouts. Society would not accept them. They became unfit. But they could manage up to the age 30. By that time, their parents are fed up. They have been trying hard and they were not listening at all to them. They were not going to the church. They were moving towards Kabul. Kulu Manali, Kathmandu, Goa, and ending up in Pune. This was their route. You know what route has brought you here. Pune was the dead end. But the new children are taking drugs because they are seeing on television, all kinds of drug stories, and certainly they become interested. And children are very curious to explore anything that they see on the television. 7-year-old children are taking drugs, hard drugs, and it is becoming a widespread danger in America. Their dreams are full of dangers, murders, suicide. That's what they are seeing almost 7.5 hours average per day. You cannot expect, if you are wasting your 1/3 of life on television, then you are going to be having a deep impact. And children understand the language of pictures. And the colorful television brings all these sensational stories. Their dreams have changed, their behavior has changed. I would like this Munich psychologist to survey a place where television has not entered. And I am absolutely certain he will have to support Sigmund Freud's hypothesis. And if he really wants to go deeper into his search, he should go to the aboriginals, where not even television has not entered, even the priest has not reached, even the god is unheard of. People are living naturally. No repressive, no inhibitory morality. If he goes to those places, he will be surprised to know. First, he should explore countries where television is not yet come. Because these will be the children whom Sigmund Freud has studied. I know children in India, almost 90% or more than 90% India has no idea of television or movies. Small villages. There I have come across people who have not even seen a railway train. Electricity has not reached to many places, so there is no question. And television has just been introduced in India. It's only big cities, Bombay and New Delhi and Calcutta and Madras, may be having television. But the most of the major part of the country, you can study children there. I have studied children for my own purposes, and I can give a guarantee that if television and movies have not reached, you will find Sigmund Freud's hypothesis absolutely correct. And if you go to the aboriginals, particularly one tribe of the aboriginals in Burma has been studied by psychologists, and they could not believe it. That tribe has never been in any war. They don't fight with each other, not even in their dreams. they don't have so many dreams as you have. There are hundreds of people in those tribes which have never dreamt. When you talk about dreams, they just look at you, what you are talking about. When we are asleep, we are asleep. What do you mean by a dream? In their language, there is no word for the dream. And if once a while a child dreams, or a man dreams anything, for example, having a fight with some neighbor, or having a love affair with some woman, the first thing in the early morning he has to confess to his parents the dream. And then all elders of the village gather together to figure out who is the person that he has murdered in his dream, or was fighting with him in his dream, and who is the woman that he has fallen in love in his dream. And they figure out, he gives that complete detailed description, very vivid and very real. So they can figure out who is the person. It is a small tribe. And then the elders tell the person who has been dreaming that you should take sweets and flowers and gifts to that woman to get her know that you have misbehaved with her in the dream and you have come to be forgiven. Go with an apology to the woman or to the man with whom you have been violent. And unless they forgive you, don't return. Sit there. And obviously, the person has nothing to do. You have not murdered him. You just dreamt. So obviously he is willing to forgive you, and this is their culture for thousands of years, that even the dream has to be taken in account. And the ultimate result is that the people ordinarily don't dream. Only once in a while somebody dreams. And that happens only when he has repressed something natural. For example, he has been looking at a woman with lust. But could not express it in reality. Hence the dream comes as a substitute to wish fulfillment. And that society knows far better psychoanalysis than our so-called civilized world. They have been psychoanalyzing for thousands of years, and their method is far more effective. They have relieved people's sleep completely of dreams. They know authentic sleep, what Patanjali calls dreamless sleep. He divides your states of mind in four: the so-called waking state, the dream state, deeper than is dreamless sleep, and deeper than that is samadhi, a real awakening. The first is called so-called waking. The last is called real awakening, which makes you a Buddha. But these aboriginal tribes don't have the dream state at all. From waking state, they simply move into dreamless sleep. And they are innocent. utterly graceful. Not a single war in their whole history, not a single murder in their whole history, not a single suicide in their whole history. And they are just like flowers, innocent, natural. And you call yourself civilized, and you call them uncivilized, primitive, pagans. So, if this psychologist is really interested, first he should study people who don't know television, who don't know movies. And he will find hypothesis of Sigmund Freud absolutely correct. And then he should study those aboriginals who have lived so naturally, without any repressive church, without any Christianity, without any god, without any priest, just like animals, just like birds, just like trees. Part of this immense existence, naturally flowing. They don't have dreams at all. Once in a while somebody may have a dream, but once in a while. And then the elders of the society gathered together, what has to be done? First one has to figure out who was really the person he dreamt. Give the whole detail. And then go with an apology and with some gifts, sweets, fruits, flowers. They are poor people. Just offer these gifts and ask for their forgiveness, because in your dream you have been nasty to them, angry to them, violent to them, lustful to them. Now it is absolutely obligatory that you should ask their forgiveness. Unless they forgive you, just sit down in front of their houses. This is more authentic psychoanalysis, not lying on the couch of a psychiatrist or psychoanalyst and just talking about your dreams. It goes on and on, because every day you are repressing so much that it bubbles up in the dreams. No psychoanalysis has ever been complete. Not a single man is there in the whole world whose psychoanalysis is complete. It cannot be complete, because every day you are creating fresh material for new dreams. You go on getting analyzed, and you go on getting repressed by the priest in the name of God. God and priest together have conspired against human consciousness so deeply and so violently that they have disturbed your waking state, they have disturbed your dream state. And because these states are so much disturbed, you cannot go beyond. This disturbance keeps you engaged and occupied. People who are moving directly from the waking state to the dreamless sleep are very easily capable of slipping down to the fourth stage. That's why the ancient Zen masters continuously say you have just to relax. You don't have to do anything. It is not a question of doing. It is a question of non-doing. Just relax and rest so that you can reach to the fourth stage, where you suddenly are awake for the first time. Then you know that your so-called wakefulness was not authentic. It was very small, thin layer, very fragmentary, not of much use. You will be surprised to know that in these aboriginal societies there are no Buddhas. there is no need. Those people are naturally entering finally into the fourth stage. As they become more and more experienced and become more and more peaceful, centered, they start moving into the fourth state without any effort, without any teaching, without any scripture. If you understand me, a natural life will end up into enlightenment without any effort. You will suddenly find yourself, you are enlightened. That's why no recognition is given to the enlightened person. That is a natural phenomenon. Just as every rose bush, if watered well, if allowed to have some sunlight, if given good soil, it will come to flowering. That is not a miracle. Every man comes to flowering, he becomes a Gautam Buddha without any effort. And because every natural human being is bound to become an enlightened person, no recognition is taken off. It is just as childhood is followed by youth, and youth is followed by middle age, and middle age is followed by old age, and you know, and old age is followed by death. Just a natural sequence. Buddhahood should be a natural sequence. It is not because of your God and your priest and your scriptures. They are preventing you. Freedom from all these is absolutely necessary. And strangely enough, every government knows that television is harming people immensely, ruining their physical health, ruining their mental sanity. Still, because all the great corporations which support the politicians for their elections own these televisions. Church owns its own television stations, its own radio stations, its own magazines, its own newspapers, in different names, so you will not know it. One of the British publishers, Selden, has published 8 of my books. Neither I had any idea that it was just a fake name. Behind was the church. As the church authorities became aware that my books are being published, then I came to know the man who was the manager of Selden Press must have become into my thoughts, my approach to things. So without asking the church, he continued publishing. 8 books he published. And then he informed me that the church has found that I have been publishing your books, so they have put an absolute ban. So please forgive me, I will not be able to publish anymore. And these books they have ordered should be given to be recycled, whatever you have published. So they are destroyed. But the man must have been in great love with me. He did not give it to the recycling factory. He sold them to a second-hand bookstore. And one of my sannyasins, he informed that you can get from the second-hand bookstore. So all the books we got at a throwaway price. But it was the manager who managed it. And then we became aware that it was a fake name, Selden. You will not think that it has anything to do with the church. All great newspapers, I have been informed from Germany, are owned by the church. But you will not know. Television stations are owned by a church, radio stations are owned by a church, satellites are owned by a church, and big corporations. Big corporation has not come into people's eyes. They are international, like Coca-Cola. Only Soviet Union was not aware of Coca-Cola. But now, Comrade Gorbachev has brought Coca-Cola into Soviet Union. Now, the only thing international is Coca-Cola. Wherever you go, you will find billboards declaring everything goes easy with Coca-Cola. And there are 10 corporations rising that a survey says that in the coming 10 years, only 10 corporations will be there all over the world because they are purchasing small corporations. Small corporations cannot compete. These 10 corporations will be having all the wealth of the world in different names, so you cannot even suspect. A new kind of imperialism and a very subtle kind that you will not be able to figure out that who is behind it. These corporations own almost all the television and their interest is not in people's psychology or their disturbance. Their whole interest is 50% time is devoted to advertisement. That is their income. But that income is possible only if millions of people are seeing their program. Otherwise, nobody is going to advertise. To attract millions of people to the program, they have to make it as sensational as possible. It has to be a triangle story, two women, one man, or two men, one woman, and then murder and suicide and mental sickness and insanity. And all kinds of sensations have to be brought every day. It is the same story that goes on. And they don't allow you to see the whole story. They give you a figment, a fragment, then comes the advertisement. When you are getting hot, excited, then suddenly comes the advertisement. In that hot state, vulnerable, you immediately swallow the advertisement. You don't care whether it is healthy, whether you need it or not. It simply gets an imprint on your mind. And again the story comes. So you don't have even time to think over what has got into your mind. They don't give you the chance to think. Again the story starts. You forget all about the advertisement. A fragment again, and again the same advertisement is repeated. It goes on from 6 o'clock till 12 o'clock in the night. And people are just being imprinted by all kinds of nonsense and stupidity. Television has become one of the great danger to humanity. It could have been a great bliss, a great blessing. It could have been tremendously useful as education. According to me, all television stations should belong to the universities, to the colleges, to the schools, and they should have programs which educate people. No advertisements. That is not education. That is miseducation. That is exploitation. They should teach people history, geography. Small children who cannot get it through language will be easily interested in learning the history, in learning geography, in learning other kinds of subjects, sciences, literature, fiction, poetry, painting, all kinds of arts can be brought to children of all grades. So there must be television stations for small children, and then there should be for the college graduates, and there should be the highest grade postgraduate and research people, professors, because professors have to be continuously made aware of all new kinds of discoveries. Otherwise they are lagging behind, almost 20 years behind, because they had read 20 years before when they were in their postgraduate classes, but that knowledge has become out of date. To update professors will be very easy by television. To bring students' tremendous interest into all kinds of subjects, in whatever they are interested, if they are interested in music, they can be taught music, musical instruments. If they are interested in painting, they can be taught painting, sculpture. They can be taught meditation. All kinds of possibilities are there once television is taken out of the hands of the exploiters and out of the hands of the religious preachers. And then these children will prove Sigmund Freud's hypothesis absolutely. This man has taken a revengeful attitude. It always happens because Sigmund Freud is the founder of psychology. Every psychologist feels to take the revenge, just as every child feels to take the revenge with the parents. This research simply shows a very deep hidden secret of this psychologist, that he wants to take revenge with the fatherly figure, Sigmund Freud. Otherwise, this was so simple to understand that technology has brought so many things to the children which were not available in Sigmund Freud's time. The new children were not available to him to study, and neither he was aware of the aboriginal children. He was aware only of Christian and Jewish children, who are both repressive religions. Christianity is a child of Judaism, so is Mohammedanism. All three religions born out of India are branches of Judaism. Repressive, the God is angry, the God is jealous, the God is going to be punish you with eternal hellfire. But these words did not get into the minds of the children. They start getting after 4 years of age. But television can be watched before 4 years of age. Small children are watching the television because they know the language of pictures and color. Their world consists of pictures. That's why in children's books you have to first print a big picture. If you want to teach them what is mango, you have to put a big picture of mango. Saliva comes first, then comes the word mango. Looking at the picture, the child starts feeling to eat it. And the picture becomes associated by and by with the word mango. As the child grows, the mango picture becomes smaller, smaller, smaller. In the university, pictures completely disappear from the books. Words become very small, longer, complicated. Complex sentences. Now the child has moved from pictorial language to an alphabetical language, to words from pictures. Now words don't have color, and words don't have that kind of impact which a child can understand. So what this psychologist has to understand, I am going to send him the whole discourse that your hypothesis is absolutely wrong and biased, and it is just a revenge against Sigmund Freud. Otherwise, a conscious researcher would have looked what changes have happened between the time of Sigmund Freud and our time. Are the children the same that you are surveying? They are not the same children. Then you cannot condemn Sigmund Freud's hypothesis, because he was studying a different kind of children. Those children are disappearing from the West completely. So this hypothesis will be accepted. That's why I have taken it for your consideration, that this hypothesis is wrong. This is bound to be accepted, because you can study the children, and that study will support it. But the reason is television, not the children. Remove the television and you will find the children exactly as Sigmund Freud has found them. But he also missed the Aboriginal children, which don't have any dreams at all. He could not have conceived that there are people who don't have any dreams, because the Christian Judaic religion is so repressive that people who have been brought up in that culture cannot conceive that there are still Aboriginal people around the world, hidden in deep forests, who are absolutely natural beings. They have never heard that there is anything to be repressed. Just in the middle of India, there is a state, Bastar. It used to be an independent state under British rule, and the king of Bastar was my friend. And he became my friend by a strange incidence. We both were traveling in the same compartment, and we both looked alike. He had a beard, exactly the same size as I had at that time, and he used to wear the same kind of long robe with a lungi wrapped around. So we were sitting in the same compartment looking at each other. Wondering that this is strange. And he was also looking at me and watching that, what is the matter? Finally, he asked me that we look both so alike. From where you are coming? I told him. He said, it's strange. And where are you going? So we were going to the same place, Gwalior. And we were going to be the guests of the same palace of the Gwalior Maharani, the Queen of Gwalior. We were both going to participate in an annual conference she used to call. A world conference of all religions. So he was going to represent the Aboriginal idea, because they are pagans, they don't have any organized religion or dogma, they don't have any holy scripture, they don't have any priests. And because he was an educated person, he was going to represent pagans, and I was invited by some misunderstanding. The Maharani must have read some of my books and thought that I am a religious person. And in the first day meeting, she became so much worried, because at least 50,000 people were there in the palace grounds. Gwalior's palace is a very big palace and has acres and acres of greenery around it, and a small bungalows, and it is all walled garden. Almost half of the city belongs to the palace. And just behind the palace is a huge mountain where they run a school for all the princes and prince of the country are outside the country. That school belongs to the palace, It was created just for Gwalior's sons and daughters in the beginning. Then it became a royal school for all royal estates of India. It is a beautiful palace, and it has a huge ground where 50,000 people can sit every year. But when I spoke, she was completely shattered. She could not sleep. At 12 o'clock in the night, she knocked on my door. I had left her at 10 o'clock after the meeting. I could not think who will be knocking on my door, so I opened the door, and it was the Queen itself. She said, "I cannot sleep. You have shattered my whole mind. And now I cannot allow you to speak tomorrow." The conference was going to continue for 7 days. I spoke only one time. And she said, "My son wants to see you, but I have prohibited him." She said, "Whatever you said feels to be true, but it goes against our all beliefs, our all religious feelings." I said, "Do you think about truth, or you think about lies and consolation?" She said, "I can understand, but my young son, who is going to be the head of the state, he is too young, and he will be impressed by you immediately." She requested me that, just for my sake, even if he comes, don't allow him in. So I said, "If I am not going to speak, then I don't have to stay here. You have asked me for 7 lectures, and just 1 lecture you are finished. Let me do my job. Those 50,000 people will ask for me." She said, "I know it. Because you were the only one, they seemed to be interested," and there was absolute silence. I have never seen such silence in the crowd. The priests go on speaking, who cares? They are telling the same thing again and again, year by year, the same dogmas. For the first time, the Queen said to me that I understood what it means by pin drop silence. So they will be asking. But it is difficult, because all other participants are absolutely against you, because Hindus and Mohammedans and Christians, they were all there. So they approached the Maharani after the lecture, that if this man remains here for 7 days, then we are leaving. We cannot sit on the same stage together, because he is destroying every religion. I said, "There are so many, they can defend. I am alone." There were almost 12 people on the stage with me. They have enough time. They are 12, they can defend. The Maharani said, "I know they cannot. They don't have the guts, they don't have the argument, they don't have any idea how to defend. And you have destroyed their smallest things, which I could not have conceived can be destroyed." Just before me, one of the Shankaracharyas was speaking, and he told a small story. which I have left to tell myself, but when anybody tells it, that is a different matter. It is an ancient story he was telling. The story is that 10 blind men are crossing a flooded stream, fearing they are holding each other's hand, and somehow they manage. It is not deep, but the current is forceful. They reach to the other side, and somebody amongst them said, "We should count, because we don't know if somebody, the river has taken away, or we are all together still." So they started counting, and everybody counted, and it was always ending on 9, because he was leaving himself out. He will count others: 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. One man is missing. They all tried, but it was always stepping on the 9. One man sitting by the side of the road, working in his field, was watching all this nonsense that was going on. All the 10 blind men started crying and weeping, because some of them, some friend of them, the current has taken. So finally the man came up and he said, "What is the matter?" They said, "We were 10 and one person has gone with the river. Now we are only 9. The man immediately looked, they were 10. So he said, "I have been watching. Now I will count. Stand up. I will go on sleeping. First I will slap the first person, one slap, and I will say 1. Then I will slap the second person twice, and I will say 2. And the third person 3 times, and I will say 3. And this way I will count." They said, "Anyway, just bring our 10th man." So he counted, and they were 10, and they were rejoicing, although they were beaten well. It is an ancient story, and the Shankaracharya was telling it, that this is the way we are leaving us alone and looking around the whole world, trying to find peace, trying to find bliss, trying to find God, and not looking inwards, not counting ourselves. After him I was to speak, and for the first time I had to criticize this story which I have been telling, but my context is totally different. So I asked the Shankaracharya that your story is absolutely stupid, because you have first to explain how they came to know they are 10. Before they started into the river moving, how they managed to count? And if they knew the counting, how they forgot it just by crossing the river? Now he was at a loss. I said, there are only 2 possibilities. One is somebody else has counted them just as somebody else counted them afterwards. He said, "Perhaps." I said, "That's the trouble with borrowed knowledge. Because somebody else has counted them, that created the trouble. It was not their own understanding that they are 10. It was somebody else understanding that they are 10, and they were carrying a borrowed knowledge. That borrowed knowledge is not going to help. When they themselves counted, The borrowed knowledge did not help at all. Again, they needed somebody else to count them. Again, the borrowed knowledge. And I am against borrowed knowledge because it is not going to help you. It is going to create more misery, more anguish, more anxiety. What happened to those blind people? And I asked the Shankaracharya, whatever you know, is it your knowledge or just borrowed? And be honest. Because I have ways to check out whether it is your knowledge or borrowed. He said, I don't know myself. I'm a scholar. I know the Vedas. I know the Upanishads. But I don't know myself. I said, then you are a blind man sooner or later passing any current. You will be in difficulty. You will always remain dependent on others. You will never be free. And without freedom, there is no spirituality. For the first time, I suddenly found the criticism. I had never thought about it. But the queen said to me, this is dangerous. You finish that Shankaracharya. And everybody was laughing and enjoying. Now that Shankaracharya is very angry, he's sitting in my palace. I was staying in the guest house. Everybody was having a guest house. They had at least 20 guest houses in the thick garden, huge and ancient trees. The Shankaracharya was sitting in the main palace where the queen and the king lived. And he said, I am not going to leave unless you make the arrangement. Either we all will leave, 12 persons. I said, don't be worried. I will speak 3 hours continuously. Those 12 persons are not needed. I will manage the 50,000 people. In fact, tomorrow you will have difficulty because more people will be coming. These 50,000 people are going to tell at least 100,000 people. So don't be worried. There is going to be a double gathering. You have to make arrangements. Let these 12 people go. I will manage 7 days. He said, but I cannot do that. I am an orthodox Hindu. I said, that does not matter. I will finish in 7 days all orthodoxy. She said, that I can understand, you will finish. But I cannot tell all those religious leaders to go away, and they are 12 and you are alone. I said, that does not matter, I am enough for those 12. If they don't want to sit on the same stage, make another stage for them. And just I will sit alone on my stage. And I will take care of each of the 12. He said, you are going to create trouble. And I want no trouble. I said, then, if you want to keep those people, you don't understand, you will be in trouble. At that moment, the Bastar Maharaja also came in. He was staying in the next room in the guest house with me. And he said to me that, you have done a great job, and if you have to leave, I am coming with you. That's how we became friends. and he invited me to his estate. So from Gwalior I went directly to Bastar. It is far away from Gwalior. And he introduced me to the people of Bastar. They are aboriginals. They live almost naked. Only they put a small piece of cloth around them when they come to the main capital, Jagdalpur. Otherwise, in the forest, in the mountains, they live naked. You can ask a woman, even by touching her breast, that what is this? And she will not feel embarrassed, she will not feel offended, she will say, this is just to give milk to my child. No idea that you are being offensive, you are touching her breast. She is not going to scream and she is not going to any police station. In fact, there is no police station there. The people are so innocent that when rarely it happens that somebody kills someone. It has happened perhaps twice in this Maharaja's lifetime. Then the person who has killed comes to the capital himself, because the capital only has the police station and the court. And he goes to the police station and informs that I have killed a man and I need to be punished. Otherwise, no one would have ever known that he has killed anybody. Nobody goes into those deep forests. They live in caves. Nobody goes there. And they have such beautiful caves. And they are such beautiful people. You will not find anybody fat. You will not find anybody thin. They look all alike. And they live long. And they live very naturally. Even about sex, they are very natural. Perhaps the only natural people left in India. And exactly what they do has to be done all over the world if you want people not to be perverted. And behind all kinds of mental sicknesses is sexual perversion. And in Bastar I found for the first time people are totally natural. After a girl and a boy come of age, that is 14 and 13, they have in their villages, just in the middle of the village, a small hall, just made of bamboos, as their huts are made. The moment a girl starts having periods, she has to stay in the central hall. By the time a boy is 14, sexually potent, he has to live. All the girls and the boys who have become sexually mature, they start living together, sleeping together, with one condition. And that is a beautiful condition, that no boy should sleep with a girl more than 3 days. So you have to become acquainted with every girl of the village, and every girl has to become acquainted with every boy of the village. Before you decide to marry someone, you must know every woman of the village. So there is no question arising afterwards that you start feeling lustful to some woman. You have lived with all the women of your age, and it is your choice after the experiment with all the women. And there is no jealousy at all, because from the very beginning everybody is living with every girl every boy has the chance to be acquainted with every girl of the village, and every girl has the chance to be acquainted with every boy of the village. So there is no question of any jealousy. There is no competitive spirit at all. Just an experiment, an opportunity for every child to know sex with different people and then find out who suits you, with whom you were the most happy, with whom you settled harmoniously, with whom you felt your heart. Perhaps this is the only scientific way to find a soul match. But these people are called uncivilized, and missionaries are doing great job of civilizing them, opening schools, hospitals. They don't need hospitals. They are so healthy people that these missionaries bring all kinds of diseases to them. They have never heard about gonorrhea. They have never heard about all kinds of perverted diseases. The missionaries bring them, and then the hospital. The missionaries bring the idea to them that you are poor. They have never thought about it. They are all equal, equally poor. There is no question of comparison. And they are living perfectly well, healthy, on one meal a day. And they are more healthy than anybody else in the world. Just recently, scientists have been experimenting on rats. And they were puzzled. They kept two categories of rats, the same kind. To one category they were giving as much food as they wanted. American rats. And to the other category, the Bastar rats, they were giving only one time. And they were surprised. The rats who were given whatever they wanted had only half of the age than the rats who were giving only one time. They had the double age, twice the American fellows. So Bastar people live longer, although they don't know how long they have lived because they cannot count. They live 100 years very easily, 120 very easily. If you search in the deeper forest, perhaps you can find a person who has lived 150 years. Just they don't know. You have to figure out. And they don't look that old either. Even the oldest person goes on working. Life is hard. But it is beautiful. Every night, particularly when it is moon nights, they dance to abandon. The whole day they have been working hard, and in the night they dance. All the women, all the men together. No question that you have to dance with your wife. People go on changing partners. It is a social phenomenon. It is not a question of possessiveness that you should dance with your own wife. And if she is dancing with somebody else, then you are looking jealous, you are looking murderous. I have watched their dances. They look so beautiful. There is no question of any lust, because they are fulfilled, sexually fulfilled, physically fulfilled, they don't have dreams. I have asked many. I have asked the Maharaja. He said, they don't have dreams, but I have, because I am an educated person. They destroyed me. I was born in these hills, and I would have loved to remain just as uneducated, as uncultured as these people. Their joy is infectious. Their laughter is infectious. But they don't have any dreams. There is no need for dreams. Dream is a need created by a repressive morality, by a repressive god, by a repressive priesthood. These are the people who have created dreams. And then another priesthood has come into being, the psychoanalyst. They exploit your dreaming. One priesthood has created the dreams, another priesthood, and both were Jews. Jesus was a Jew and Sigmund Freud is a Jew. Now one Jew has created Christianity, the most repressive religion in the world, and the other Jew has created psychoanalysis to analyze your dreams, and both are having great fun. Both are the most highly paid people, psychoanalysts and the missionaries, and the priests, and the bishops, and the cardinals, and the pope. Psychoanalysis will remain incomplete unless it comes to understand the people who don't have dreams. Then you will have to change the whole idea. It is not a question of analyzing people's dreams that you are going to give them mental health. It is a question how to help them from dreamless sleep to move, relax into the fourth stage called Turiya, Samadhi, Satori. Where one becomes utterly awakened. The state of a Gautam Buddha. And a good news before I take the sutras. A famous New York sculptress, Martin Wagel, has just now taken sannyas from the New York Center of Neo Sannyas International. She is a world famous sculptress, and she must have been hearing my tapes and must have been hearing every day Sardar Gurdayal Singh's name. So she has, without seeing, she has not come yet to Pune, and she has not seen Sardar Gurdayal Singh. But this is the sensitivity of an artist, a creativity. She has made a statue of Sardar Gurdayal Singh. And she has sent me a picture of the statue, whether she is right. And I was amazed. She is absolutely right. It looks almost the picture of Sardar Gurdayal Singh. Yeah. the first question, so-called modern Christians, particularly young Protestants, talk about God as if He is not a person. Like God is everywhere, in every being, in every tree, in nature, not a person hidden in the clouds. Do they get the point, or is it just out of cunningness because they see that the old man God has no grounds at all and no future? It is out of absolute cunningness, because they go on talking about that God is not a person, then why they go to the church? Then why do they continue to pray to God as a person? Because if God is not a person, prayer should be stopped. Going to the church should be stopped. If God is not a person, then Jesus cannot be His begotten Son. Then you have to drop the idea that Jesus is related to God, especially if God is really everywhere, then He is not more in Jesus Christ than in you. Then why you should worship? Then what is the function of the priest? If there is no God, as a person, the priest has to disappear. That's why I say these people are simply repeating the approach of Zen, which has become known to the West now, that there is no God, but they cannot say it exactly, there is no God. It hurts their programmed minds, so they are finding excuses in such a way that it appears God is, but it is not a person. But they don't understand the implications. They say God is everywhere. If God is everywhere, then no place can be called sacred. If God is everywhere, in every being, then you cannot be violent to the animals. You cannot hunt in animals. You cannot kill animals for your food. You are killing God. If God is in every being, then everybody has to be vegetarian. Nobody can be non-vegetarian. Otherwise, you are killing God and eating God. In every tree in nature, and you are cutting trees, you are destroying ecology of nature. Just when India became independent 40 years before, there were near about 30 million trees in the country. Now there are only 3 million. 27 million trees have been cut. And the Christians are talking now that God is everywhere, even in trees. Hindus have been talking it for centuries, that God is everywhere. That is the meaning of omnipresent. And if God is everywhere, then why you go to the church? Why you go to the temple? Why you go to the mass? And why do you listen to the sermons? Why you carry a holy Bible or holy Quran? I don't think a non-personal God can write Vedas and Bible and Quran. Or a non-personal God can send messengers and prophets and messiahs. Then all your holy scriptures have to be burnt. If you are honest, and all your churches have to be demolished. If you are honest, and all your priesthood has to be told that you have exploited enough, just now start working. Unless you work, you will not have to eat. If you don't do that, then it is mere cunningness, because you cannot prove the personal God anymore. You are trying to create an impersonal God. But your whole religion continues to be the same. It does not change. It is such a great change from personal God to impersonal God that your whole religion will go through a revolution. No church, no priest, no holy scripture. Then the whole existence becomes the holy scripture. And if God is everywhere, there is no need to pray. Closest is your own being. So first find out God in your own being. But still, these Christians are not interested in meditation. These Christians are still praying to an impersonal God. Prayer is absolutely absurd. And if these Christians do understand the implications, then Christianity disappears. And the pagan appears again. That was the only problem. Christianity killed millions of pagans who believed in the whole nature, in the whole existence as divine, who worshipped trees, who worshipped moon, who worshipped sun, who worshipped rivers, mountains, anything. Because everything was sacred. And Christianity destroyed them and converted those pagans into Christians. From impersonal God to personal God. From natural people into repressive maniacs. And now if you again disperse the personal God into the whole existence, you will have to disperse the whole Christianity. You will have to disperse all the religions. And the whole earth will be full of pagans, Zorbas. That is my effort. To create the Zorba as a solid foundation for a Buddha. Zorba is the earth. Buddha is the sky. And when these two meet, there is communion. When these two meet, there is synchronicity. When these two meet, there is revolution. You are no more the same. Neither the world is any more the same. Everything changes. In a totally new perspective, new doors open, and a new human being, and a new fresh existence, without any priest to poison your nature. No, these people, the so-called new Christian theologians, are just deceiving themselves and other Christians, because their whole structure remains the same. Just the God, because they cannot support by logic or evidence, and they can see the point of Zen, at least intellectually, not to feel inferior, they are talking about the impersonal God. That's what Eckhart was doing. That was what Saint Bernard was doing. Trying to make God impersonal, but they don't understand that it means destroying your whole structure of religion. If they are truly understanding the phenomenon, they will destroy all Bibles, all churches, popes, Vatican, all should be finished. There is no need. God is everywhere. There is no need of any priest to stand between you and the God. He is surrounding you. He is in the air. And He is within your blood and within your bones. And He is in your very marrow, and He is in your inner space, as He is everywhere. But to know that He is everywhere is not a logical conclusion. To know He is everywhere has to be an existential experience. And first you have to go into yourself. Unless you know it in yourself, you cannot say it is in trees, and it is in every animal, and it is in every living being. You are a living being. First enter in yourself. And these Christians are not talking about meditation at all. So all the talk is simply to deceive themselves and to others, as if they have risen to the same height of Zen. Just by talking, you cannot do that. You have to give evidence, proof by your every gesture, by your every action, by your every word. But I watch, I have been aware of these new Christian theologians, but their behavior is the same as any Christian. That behavior proves that their understanding is just to camouflage people's mind, to create confusion. They are protecting the old God with a new name, impersonal God, because their whole religion remains the same. How it can remain the same if the God is impersonal? That is equivalent that there is no God. There is only godliness, a quality pervading the whole cosmos. There is a beautiful story. Al-Hillaz Mansur, who became finally a great enlightened being, was murdered by the Mohammedans. He was a poor man, and he wanted to go to Kaaba, because it is a duty of every Mohammedan, at least one time in your life, you should go for a Hajj, for a holy pilgrimage to Kaaba. If you don't go, you are not a Mohammedan. At least one time. So even the poorest Mohammedans sell their houses, their land, and go at least one time to Kaaba. Mansur was very poor. His father and mother died when he was very young. So he was almost an orphan beggar. The neighbors helped him up to his young age, and then he started, because there was no education for him. People were going, there is a special month every year when from all over the world Mohammedans go to Kaaba. Many people from the village were going, and he started telling them that I would like to come, but they said you don't have any money. So he collected money from every house. But by the time he had collected money, the other pilgrims had already left. So alone he started his journey. Just outside the village, underneath a tree, was sitting a man who was going to become his master, Junaid. And he said to the young man, "Where are you going?" Al-Hillas said, "I am going to Kaaba. All the pilgrims from my village have already left." Junaid said, "Come here." The voice of Junaid was such, his eyes were such, that Al-Hillas could not say no. He said, "Give me the money." And there is no need to go anywhere. I am the Kaaba. And I have come to your village just for you. You can take 7 rounds of me as other pilgrims will be taking 7 rounds of Kaaba. That is a stone. I am a living human being." Al-Hillas was so much magnetically impressed by the man that he gave his whole money to him, took 7 rounds, and Junaid said, "Now you can go to your village, and I will be leaving tomorrow morning, so if you want to come with me, you can come." He went to village, the villagers asked, "What happened? You had gone for Kaaba, it used to take 3 months walking to Kaaba and 3 months to come, and you are back just within half an hour. Where is the money?" Alila said, "What to do? I met Kaaba just outside the village. He was sitting under a tree." They said, "You idiot, you have given the money to that Kaaba." He said, "He asked, and he told me to take 7 rounds around him, so I took 7 rounds, and I am feeling so fulfilled and so dignified that Kaaba himself has come." They said, "You come with us. We want to see who is this man who has cheated you. You are a simpleton. How Kaaba can come here and for you?" He said, "You can come. Tomorrow morning I am leaving with Kaaba." He said, "You come with us. First let us see who is this fellow. He is a man?" Al-Hillas said, "Of course." And a very magical man. I think it is Kaaba, personified. They said, "You keep quiet, you just follow us." The whole village gathered, and they could see the man has a tremendous light around him. It was night now, and they could feel, as they started coming closer to him, that he was in deep silence with closed eyes, but the light was radiating. And Al-Hilas was not wrong. There is immense attraction. The man has a charisma. They all went around him. Junaid opened his eyes and said, "First, put the money. I have traveled to your village and you are doing your Hajj without paying the money. Bring the money first." Alilla said, "Now you know that he is not an ordinary Kaaba. He speaks too." And the whole village, whatsoever they could bring, brought and gave to him. And Junaid allowed them to take a round. And the day after, he left with Al-Hilas. The whole village has come to send them off. They thought this Al-Hilas, although he was an orphan, proved to be more blessed than we are. He has found a master. Only the enlightened man can say such a thing, that there is no God, because he knows God is a quality. It is the fragrance. You cannot catch hold of it. But it is everywhere. Wherever life is, wherever laughter is, wherever love is, that quality pervades, penetrates your heart, and in meditation it goes to the deepest part of your being. Only then you can say, either there is no God. That does not mean you are atheist, that simply means you are denying a personal God, a creator God, and you are accepting existence itself as divine. But then there is no church, and then there is no priest, and then there is no holy scripture. If these neo-theologians are really sincere, honest human beings, they should start destroying the holy scriptures, at least the Christian ones, because they are Christians, and they should start demolishing Vatican, taking away the power from the priests, abolishing the monasteries. But they are not doing anything of the kind. So it is all bullshit. Just bullshit and nothing else. The Sutra. Our beloved master Sodai, who was born in 738 in China and died in 820, was a disciple of Sekito. Sodai stayed at Mount Nangaku under Sekito for 3 years, then went to Mount Suko, where he saw Matazu. Matazu asked, "What did you come here for?" You can see the difference between so-called religious people and the Zen masters. Matazu knew that he is coming from Sekito rather than feeling happy that he has got a disciple from Sekito, and his number of disciples has increased by one at least. Matazu said, "What did you come here for? Sekito was enough for you." This This is the beauty of Zen. An immense reverence for everyone who is enlightened. There is no competition at all. Never heard in the world of Zen the word competition. No effort to convert anybody. Mataji simply asked him, why you have come here? For what? Everything was available from where you are coming. So I said, I came here for Buddha's birth celebrations, Janma Darshan. Buddha's birthday was coming, and Buddha's birthday has a very special coincidence. He was born on the same full moon night. He became enlightened the same month, the same full moon night. And he died 82 years afterwards on the same month, the same full moon night. A strange man. Birth, enlightenment, death, all happened on the same full moon night in the same month of the year. So his birthday is also his enlightenment day. It is also his death celebration. So in a single day, all three experiences happen. That's why for Zen, the full moon has become something special. Because everything that happened to Buddha happened on the full moon night. So in every Zen monastery, the full moon night, people just sit under their trees and watch the full moon. The full moon has become symbolically connected with Gautam Buddha. And just watching and witnessing the full moon, they enter into deep meditation. And full moon night has a speciality that is now being recognized by science itself. They had to come from the wrong side, because scientists are living on the wrong side of the earth in the west. They became aware that more murders happen on the full moon night, more suicides happen on the full moon night, more people go insane on the full moon night. It's strange, because this full moon night certainly affects people and their psychology. It affects the ocean, that is known fact. But on the full moon night, it becomes very tidal waves, as if the ocean is trying to reach to the moon. And man consists 80% of ocean water. So something in him also starts feeling a subtle vibration. And as scientists say, that the first living being was the fish. Man is the other end of progress. In the beginning was the fish. So we have a very deep connection. Our real forefathers lived in the ocean. They were fish. So don't eat fish. You are eating your own forefathers. And that is nasty. And I see people carrying tinned fish, forefathers. thinned. And people love eating fish. If life was born in the ocean, then life is bound to be affected when the ocean is affected. There is a deep connection, underlying currents. But Western psychologists became aware from the wrong side, suicide, murder, madness. The East became aware that more people have become enlightened on full moon night. In fact, almost all, except one, Mahavira. He became enlightened on the no moon night, Amavas. The full moon night is called Purnima. The moon has become perfect, Purna. And the no moon night is when there is no moon at all. Absolute darkness. Except Mahavira, nobody has become enlightened on Amavas, no moon night. And therefore, Mahavira's name was not Mahavira. Mahavira means a great warrior. His name was Vardhaman. But because he became enlightened on Amavas, no moon night, he proved that he can go against the current. It was natural for everybody to become enlightened on the full moon night. But this fellow, Mahavira, tried to go against the normal order of things and still managed to become enlightened. In India, people have completely forgotten why they every year on a particular Amavas, no moon night, celebrate Deepavali, a festival of lights. You must have seen when people start putting all kinds of candles, lamps, lights on their houses. This is the night when Mahavira became enlightened, and this festival is in remembrance of Mahavira, and nobody even thinks of Mahavira. Those firecrackers are in celebration of Mahavira. He has done certainly something unique, which has never happened before and never happened afterwards. So it is perfectly right to call him Mahavira, a great warrior, a very strong man, otherwise it has been almost impossible for anyone to become enlightened. On no moon night. In Zen, the full moon night every month, they watch the whole night, the moon. And as they go on witnessing the moon, a deep tranquility and silence descends over them. And particularly the night when Gautama Buddha was born, became enlightened and died. So this is a special, very special night for the people belonging to the small stream of Zen. So Dai said, I have come here for Buddha's birthday celebrations. Matazu was a very famous master, and perhaps Sodai thought Sekito was not that famous. Slowly, slowly he became famous after his death. But Matazu was famous while he was alive, very famous, because of his strange behavior. So Dai must have thought that the celebrations of this moon, it will be good to go to Matazu. Something may transpire. So he said, I have come here to celebrate the birth of Gautam the Buddha. Matazu said, Buddha has no birth. No death. Buddha is eternal. Life has no beginning, no end. It is eternal. The very word birth belongs to the world of delusion. Because that which is authentic in you is never born. It has been coming from one house to another house, from one body to another body. But it is eternal in itself, so no birth, no death happens to it. It happens only to the outside house, which becomes tattered. So it has to be renewed, or you have to move in a new house. Matazu said, Buddha has no birth, no death. The very idea of birth and death is delusion. You are from Mount Nangaku, but it seems that you have not yet known that you need Sekito. He is your master. And I don't think it is right time for you, or there is any need to change your master. You have not allowed your master yet to transform you. So you should go back. You cannot stay here. Hearing that, Sodai went to Sekito. On meeting the master, Sodai asked Sekito, what is Buddha? He must have been thinking all the way coming back that Matazu said there is no birth of Buddha and no death of Buddha. Then what is Buddha? Buddha is equivalent to awakened life. Sekito replied, there is no Buddha nature in you. So Dai asked, what about all living beings? Sekito replied, they have Buddha nature. Sekito was strange in his own way. Matazu went to very strange behavior to the extreme, but Sekito was not either just a normal enlightened master. He has his own uniqueness. He said, all living beings have Buddha nature, but Sodai, you don't have it. This is a very strange statement. Why this poor Sodai does not have the Buddha nature? when all living beings, even animals, even trees have Buddha nature, only Sodai has not. Sodai asks, why don't I have not? Sekitu said, because you don't accept it. The only question is of recognition, of accepting, of remembering. Even if you have immense treasures, but you are unaware of them, what is the point, whether you have them or not? An ancient story says, that one master and his disciple were moving from one village to another village. But they started late because people were trying to persuade them to stay a little more in their village. Starting late, the master was continuously looking into his bag that he has never done before. And the disciple was behind. He was also thinking, what is the matter? Why he goes on looking into the bag and then closes it? And again he said, we should go faster. We have to reach the other village before sunset. The disciple was simply could not believe, because there have been many nights they have stayed in the wildest parts of the forest where there was all kinds of dangers, and the master has never bothered. They have slept soundly under the trees, knowing perfectly well there is danger all around. But what has happened today? He wants to reach to the other village before sunset. There is danger. What kind of danger? And then they stopped on a well, and the master had to wash his face and do his evening prayer before the sunset. So he was in a hurry. He gave the bag to the disciple and told him, keep it carefully. That too was strange. He has given the bag many times to him, but he has never said it, keep it carefully. Of course, he has always kept it carefully. So when the master started drawing the water from the well, the disciple looked in the bag, and then he knew what was the problem. He was carrying a golden brick, complete brick, pure gold. He knew now what is the danger. So while he was praying, and he was praying quickly and fast, he threw that golden brick by the side of the well into the forest and took a stone of the same weight and put it in the bag. The master quickly finished his prayer and immediately took the bag, felt the weight because the sun was setting and it was getting dark. Feeling the weight and touching the bag, he was perfectly satisfied. They started moving, and master said, we have to run. We have to reach the village anyway. We cannot stay in the night in the forest. It is dangerous. After 2 miles of running, both were tired, huffing, puffing, finally, the master said, it seems to be we are on a wrong track because there seems to be no village ahead, far away. We can see not even a single light, and the danger is there. The disciple said, don't be worried. I have thrown the danger near that well. He said, what? He looked, he took out the stone, he said, you threw that golden brick and I had told you to keep it carefully. He said, I have kept it carefully. 2 miles, you have also been keeping it carefully, the stone. Not knowing that it is a stone, you were worried. Now, can we stay overnight? He said, no, there is no problem. You really throw away the whole danger. They slept very well in the night. It is a question, if you don't know, you can carry a stone as if it is gold. And you can carry gold, if you don't know, as if it is nothing. You are carrying a tremendous treasure within you, the Buddhahood, the enlightenment. But unless you realize it, whether it is there or not does not matter. It is the same. That's why Sekito said, you don't have it. All other living beings may have it, but you don't have it. That much is certain. Because all living beings are not here, so I don't know. But about you, I know. You don't have it. He said, but why? Why make me an exception then? Every living being has it. He said, because you don't accept it. You don't explore it. You don't recognize it. You don't remember a forgotten language. At this, Sodai decided to stay with Sekito. Matazu was right. This is the right man for him. First, he must have felt a little disappointed in Matazu, a little humiliated that he has been sent back. But now he recognized Matazu was right. Sekito has the secret in his hands, and he is my master. Matazu has a different discipline, and he will have to begin from ABC. And Sekito has been working for years over me. So now everything was clear, why he has been sent back. Go to the same master who has been working on you, and he has been working perfectly rightly. His method is his. My method is different. But methods don't matter. They are pure devices to bring you a certain awareness, a certain realization, a certain deepening of your consciousness. This statement, because you don't accept it, you don't have it, just realize it and you have it. You have already have it for centuries, but you have never looked at it. At this, there must have been a lightning in Sodai's mind, in his consciousness. He decided to stay with Sekito. Later, he lived in the Sodaiji temple. He created a temple, and he lived in the temple, which used to be called Sodaiji temple, and did not go outdoors for 30 years.
This is simply symbolic and factual both. He did not go outside the temple for 30 years. After this statement of Sakito, that you have it, but because you don't accept it, you don't have it. For 30 years he did not go outside the temple, neither for 30 years he went out of himself. He went on in and in and in. Those 30 years he was not even counting. The only thing that mattered was he has to remember the hidden secret of Buddhahood. He has to give birth to his own Buddhahood, and he was gone to Matazu for the birth of Buddha's celebration. How can you celebrate Gautam Buddha's birth if your Buddha is still unborn? You can't understand what Buddha means. You can't understand what is this festival for, because you have not come to your own festival. First, you have to celebrate yourself. Only then you can celebrate all the Buddhas, awakened or asleep. You can celebrate the whole existence. And did not go outdoors for 30 years, neither out of the hut, not out of himself. He went on in and in. Went on digging. Whenever a seeker came to him, seeing the temple, and knowing that Sodai is inside meditating for 30 years, people used to bring some rice, some food, some water inside the temple, but he never asked anybody and he never went out. But in the East that has been a very virtuous act. If somebody is meditating so deeply that he has no time for food, no time to beg, no time to go out, people have a tremendous reverence for meditators. They may have been poor, they may cut their own food into two pieces. One they will eat, the other piece they will go and offer to Sodai. In the East, meditation has been thought not a personal matter. It is not that you are doing something selfish for your own self. It is something that you are doing for the whole existence. If you become blossomed, you will be a proof to everybody that they can also blossom. You will become an argument for the inner world. You will become an incentive for others also to explore. It is possible. It is not impossible. It is not that only Gautam Buddha can become enlightened. Sodai also can become. Who has been refused by Sakito by saying that you don't have it. This hit him hard. But this was the device of Sakito. He needed that much hit. So he retired into a temple, meditated for 30 years, became enlightened. But whenever anybody will come to him, he will say, go away, you don't have Buddha nature. The same device that has been used on him by his master, he went on using his whole life, and he helped many people. Because the moment he will say, you don't have Buddha nature, immediately they will ask, what about other living beings? And he will say, of course, they have it. Naturally, the same dialogue happened again and again. And the person will say, you are being absurd. If everybody has it, why I have not? And he will say, because you don't accept. Just remember, it is a forgotten nature. Just go in. Sodai was not very inventive. That's what I call a normal Zen master. He simply had one small statement, but even that small statement helped many, but could not help really a great number of people. Because those people who were coming to him were not in the same state in which he was when he had asked Sekitu. He has been meditating with Sekitu for years. He was just on the verge, the last hit. But the people who were coming were absolutely beginners. So with many, it did not transpire anything. Once in a while, if a man had come from some other master, perhaps the master is dead, or perhaps he has become tired, how long he has to wait, and became anxious, my master is becoming old, and I am not yet enlightened. People like these who have been meditating and were just on the verge, this man Sodai succeeded. By hitting them, he knew only one hit. A poor Zen master. There are poor Zen masters and rich Zen masters and super rich Zen masters. You are caught up with a super Zen master. I hit you without hitting you. I hit you in so many ways, from every direction possible. And my hits are not crude and primitive. They are very contemporary. In fact, very few contemporary people are going to understand me. Perhaps a century or 2 centuries afterwards, my hits will shake people into awakening. But right now, you are caught up. And you cannot go anywhere. Because you will not find me anywhere around the world. You will find just poor masters. Those super rich masters have disappeared from the world. We are living in a poorer world spiritually than before. Materially, we are living in a richer world. But spiritually, it is a very poor world. When Matazu was there, and Sekito was there, and Rinzai was there, and Nangaku was there, and Yaku-san was there. There were so many masters just in Japan or in China. When Gautam Buddha was here in India, there were 8 masters just in the small province of Bihar. And they transpired hundreds of people into enlightenment. But you are blessed. You have found a super rich Zen master. Don't miss this opportunity. Because the world has been becoming thinner and thinner as far as spirituality is concerned. You have to create a great rebellion around the earth. You have to upset all the organized religions. Only then people will be liberated from their mind programs. And to liberate anybody from his mental programming, conditioning, is one of the greatest virtues. You are helping that man towards freedom. But you can help only if you are free. If you are not free, there is no possibility to help. A blind man cannot help another blind man. First, you have to open your eyes and recognize your Buddhahood. And then it is very easy to trigger the same experience in others. And there are many who are ready on the verge, but there is nobody to push them. And everybody needs a push. And everybody needs a certain proof that Buddhahood is a reality. You will be surprised to know that when first Christian missionaries came to India, and they were the first to translate Buddhist scriptures into English, they did not think that a man like Buddha has ever been there. It seemed to them almost an impossibility. They have never heard about enlightenment. They have heard about prophets coming from God. They have heard about messiahs, messengers. They have heard about the only begotten Son, Jesus. They believed in them, but they have never heard about enlightenment. Was Moses enlightened? Was Jesus enlightened? They had no answer. They have never heard about the phenomenon at all. So Buddha was a strange phenomenon. The early missionaries simply cancelled the idea that he was a historical person. It took almost 100 years of research that Christian missionaries accepted that Buddha was a real human being, not a fiction. This shows that they have been believing in fictions. So they thought, deep down, nobody can believe in Jesus and his miracles. Howsoever great effort you make to believe, the doubt will remain underneath and will surface whenever your belief will be shaken by something. And it will be shaken by anything. Because a belief has no evidence, no proof. Every Christian, every Jew, every Mohammedan, every Hindu is living under such beliefs which they themselves know cannot be true. But out of fear, they are accepting it. But fear cannot transform you. Only there is one way to be transformed, and that is to find your Buddhahood. That will give you the proof that other Buddhas have happened actually. If you can become a Buddha, you are the argument, you are the proof. And unless you know Buddhahood, you cannot come to a trust that such a miracle is possible. And it is the greatest miracle. Walking on water is just stupid. It is not a miracle. It happened once, a man came to Ramakrishna. And he has trained himself in a certain yoga method. There are yoga methods in which you can throw all your air out of the body. So you become inside a vacuum. You cannot remain in that vacuum more than 10 minutes, but 10 minutes is enough to show that you can walk on water. If you are a vacuum, you can walk on the water, but it takes almost 18 to 20 years to learn that method of creating the vacuum. Once you have created the vacuum, I have seen one man only. If you can create a vacuum, you can do strange things. I have seen this man in my childhood, and my memory is absolutely clean about that man. I can see him still because he was doing such a strange thing. From his prick, he will drink water. And that is possible only if you can create a vacuum inside. Then the vacuum pulls the water, pumps the water in. But I have come only across one man. I have tried hard again to find somebody. I asked him how long it took for you. He said, it is a very difficult job. It took at least 20 years for me to create the vacuum, and only for 10 minutes. A man came to Ramakrishna and he said, I have heard much about you, but can you walk on water? Ramakrishna said, that's nothing. You can? He said, of course. Ramakrishna said, I rather like riding on a cloud. Do you know the art? He said, no, I have never heard. Ramakrishna said, how long it took for you to learn the method? The man said, 18 years continuously I have been. Ramakrishna said, you are an idiot. Because when I want to go on the Ganges, and they both were sitting by the side of the Ganges under a beautiful tree where Ramakrishna used to sit and just watch the Ganges flowing. It is a beautiful place where Ramakrishna lived, outside Calcutta. A very silent, peaceful place. Just one temple existed at that time in which he lived, just on the bank of Ganges. So Ramakrishna said, whenever I want to go there, you say that ferry boat, it takes only 2 paisa. And that to that boatman does not take from me. He says, not from you. I earn enough. I can take you without. So when I can go without even giving 2 paisa to the other side, why should I waste 18 years of my life in learning to walk on the waters? And do you think it is something of spirituality? All the fishes are doing that. And there are so many water animals. So what is the point? How do you think it is connected with your spiritual growth? You wasted your 18 years in sheer stupidity. And I don't ride on the clouds either. I was just trying to show you that even riding on the clouds will not be of any value. The real value is, are you acquainted with your Buddha? The only thing that matters. So when Christians, missionaries came to know about Buddha and his scriptures, they were very much amazed, because these sutras of Buddha have such beauty. That Bible simply fades away, looks very childish. One great missionary in Japan had gone to see a Zen master, and he believed to convert him. His idea was that if he can convert this Zen master, to whom even the emperor of Japan comes and he has a large following, just converting this one man, he can convert the whole Japan. The emperor will be converted, thousands of his disciples will be converted. So rather than working on ordinary people, it is better to work on this man. And certainly there are beautiful statements in the Bible, particularly the Sermon on the Mountain. So he took the Bible. He was greeted by the Zen master and he said, I have brought you my holy scripture and I would like to read and I would like to know your opinion. So he started reading the Sermon on the Mountain. He has gone 2-3 lines, the Zen master said, stop. Whoever wrote it, in his next life, he may become enlightened. He did not even listen to the whole sermon. He said, just stop it. Whoever wrote it, in his second life, will become enlightened. But right now, these sutras are coming from an unenlightened person. Shocked. The missionary could not understand that Jesus Christ is unenlightened. But the idea of enlightenment has never happened to the West. The very idea is missing. So it was with great difficulty for them to understand that there have been a totally different kind of people. They have always believed in God, His Son, which is not possible without God, His prophets, which come from the God, His messengers, they come from the God. Everything comes from God. That hypothesis is fundamental. If you deny that, then the whole Judaism, Christianity, Mohammedanism, all three religions flop down. They simply disappear with one hypothesis, which is absolutely unproved. Here they came to understand a totally different process. A Buddha does not come from above, he comes from below and he rises upwards. You see the difference. He becomes godly as he goes on upwards. And all Christian or Jewish or Mohammedan prophets and messiahs come from upwards to the downwards. Buddha is an evolution. It is his intrinsic potentiality that starts going upwards like a tree, and when the spring comes, it blossoms. They have never thought that man becomes godly. They have always thought only God can come down. Either Hindus believe in incarnation, God comes as Krishna, God comes as Rama. And it is absolutely clear that God has been coming so many times and the world is such a mess. What the God has done to the world? God comes in Krishna as a perfect incarnation. And what that perfect incarnation has done? Nobody asked the question. Why he has come in the first place? And if he has come, then what he has done? And Krishna has promised, and Hindus are still believing that he will be coming. His promise is when there will be danger, when humanity will be in pain and anguish and anxiety, when there will be atheism spreading in the world, when saints will be tortured, whenever there will be such a crisis to religion, I will come. But I have been asking so-called Hindu saints that last time he had come, what he has done? And why you are waiting for him? Last time he proved nothing. Even if he comes, he is not going to do anything. And how many times he has come? Hindus believe that 23 times he has already come. 24th time he has to come. But 23 times he has been a failure, that is enough proof. The 24th time he is not going to be a success. And what the prophets of the Jews have done? And what the prophets like Jesus or Muhammad have done to Christianity or to Mohammedanism? They have created an ugly human psychology, neurotic. They have not been helping the evolution of consciousness. So Buddha is completely a different category. He is not coming from any hypothesis downwards. He is not special. He is just an ordinary human being as you and me. But he starts growing his potentiality upwards. He touches the very stars. He grows roots into the earth, goes to the deepest possibility, stands vertical, leaves the horizontal plane of consciousness, which belongs to the animals, He is really a rebel, authentic rebel. Naturally, every word that has come from him has tremendous meaning, because he is not accepting any lies, any consolations, and he is not giving any lies to people or any consolations. He is simply saying what is his experience, and that can be your experience also. Buddha created a totally different world, and following came masters upon masters. But certainly there remained a very thin stream. Buddha belongs to the very intelligent people. It is not for the mediocre, it is not for the retarded, it is not for the masses. But if the intelligent people of the world rise into Buddhahood, they will help the whole humanity at least to see what is possible to a human being. What is hidden in us. And if thousands of people can bring it to blossoming, why we cannot? Every Buddha becomes a proof, an argument to the whole humanity. And he raises the level of existence spiritually. And each Buddha goes on raising the level of humanity without your knowing. You are more closer now after 25 centuries than you were when Buddha was alive. Most of you must have been around him. Most of you must have been around other Buddhas. Because you are not new to the world. You have been here always. But you never managed up to now to go as intensely as possible. Hence my insistence, don't miss this opportunity. You have to decide, you have to be very decisive that I have to bring my potential to its ultimate flowering. I have to become a celebration, a festival. I have to contribute to the beauty and truth and the divineness of existence. Basu wrote, early spring, a nameless hill knee-deep in the gauze of morning stillness. These are all statements of meditators, and Basu is a great master, and simultaneously one of the greatest haiku poets. Early spring, just visualize, early spring. It has just come fresh. The trees have been waiting for it. The earth has been waiting for it. Those who have some aesthetic sense, the painters, the poets, the musicians, the dancers, the sculptors, they have been waiting for it. It has come. Early spring, such a joy comes following with it. Such freshness all around, such fragrance of flowers, a nameless hill, knee deep, in the gauze of morning stillness. Even the hill is feeling the spring breeze, knee deep in the gauze of morning stillness. Only not I am kneeling down into my gratitude for existence, for this fresh spring once more. The mountain is also knee deep, is as grateful as I am. Early spring, a nameless hill, knee deep in the gauze of morning stillness. Those small hours before the sun rise, when the night is just going and the sun has not arrived on the horizon, are the most peaceful. And meditators have found that that is the best time to meditate, particularly in the east, when those moments are the coolest in the day. Perhaps it may not be true about the west. It may be too cold. Perhaps for the west, the best time will be midnight. It is good for the east also, but the early morning, when just the flowers are opening to welcome the sun and the birds are fluttering their wings, getting ready to sing their songs and dance into the air, and that is stillness. Night is gone, almost gone, and the morning is not born yet. That in-between moment has been given a special name in the East, Sandhya. Sandhya means the interval between day and night. So it comes two times, in the morning and in the evening, when the sun has set and the night has not come. So these two times are called Sandhya. Intervals. In these intervals, you can meditate more deeply than at any other time. It is just an existential experience of thousands of meditators. Basso is expressing his own experience in this haiku. Manisha's question, our beloved master, Paul Tillich, the Protestant theologian, asserted that God will remain somehow remote and out there, unless there is a complete turnabout in which all references to the high and the beyond are translated into terms of depth. This infinite and inexhaustible depth and ground of all beings is God. That depth is what the word God means. He who knows about depth knows about God. Would you like to comment, Manisha? Paul Tillich and all neo-theologians are trying their hard somehow to save God. And there is no way to save, he is already dead. Now he is giving another idea. Take God from there beyond the clouds and put him deep down. But what is the difference? Deep down where? In America? Because from this place, if you go on digging, you will suddenly see, my God, all Americans are walking upside down. Are they doing Sirsasana, headstand? Because from here, you will reach exactly into America. The shortest way. People are unnecessarily flying and just dig a hole. And from both the sides it can be started. From America towards India, from India towards America. And the meeting will happen just in between. But as far as America is concerned, India will be the depth. As far as India is concerned, America will be the depth. Where you are going to put God? In depth? Just trying absurdities to save the name God, because the danger is that God is becoming more and more an impossible hypothesis to prove. So change his place. Take him out from the clouds. Take him from there beyond and put him there in depth. But you cannot save him. He is dead there beyond, and he will be dead in his grave in depth. You are digging only a grave. Paul Tillich is just a grave digger and nothing else. And you can see it clearly that he is talking, God will remain somehow remote and out there. Unless there is a complete turnabout, but still, the distance will be the same. First he was beyond the clouds, now it will be deep inside the earth. In fact, it was easy to go to the clouds. Going inside the earth will be more difficult. And you don't know what is inside the earth, volcanoes. It is all hot and melted. The deeper you go, you will come to a point when everything is melted. Fire is still alive that comes through the volcanoes, you can see it. You are putting God there? I like the place. That will be his funeral pyre. This infinite and inexhaustible depth and ground of all beings is God. But he will cling to the word God. There is no change. Just the place has been changed. God is the same. He has moved the house. That depth is what the word God means. First he was the height, now he is the depth. But he is. He who knows about depth knows about God. Great. Those who have known the depth are the height, are the people who have declared there is no God. There is only a quality, a fragrance, which you cannot catch hold of, but you can feel, overwhelmed by it. But it is not God. It is the very flavor of existence itself. It is the very life. Why create an unnecessary hypothesis? Be a little scientific. In science, it is an accepted fact that no unnecessary hypothesis should be accepted. Do with as minimum hypothesis as possible. Because every hypothesis creates new problems and solves nothing. And particularly unproved hypotheses, which for centuries men have been trying to prove and has failed. All theologians have failed. No theologian has been able to give any proof for God. They are trying to do, Manisha, something impossible. God is dead, and it is good and great that God is dead, because it brings freedom and dignity to life, to existence. It destroys our spiritual slavery. It gives us a great pride that we are existence and nobody is above us. One of the Baul mystics, Chandidas, has a beautiful statement. Sabar upar manus sat, Tahar upar nai. It is a Bengali mystic. The statement is in Bengali. Sabar upar manus sat. Above all is the truth of man. Tahar upar nai. And beyond that, there is nothing. This is what I call the dignity of man, of life, of existence. Why unnecessarily drag humanity into slavery? Paul Tillich and all those who are trying to save God, the neo-theologians of Christianity, are going to fail, because all that can they do is give new words, new meanings, new references, new addresses, but when you reach, you will find nothing. Neither he is beyond there, nor he is in the depth somewhere hiding. God does not exist, has never been in existence. Life exists. Celebrate life, rejoice life, let life be your freedom, your pride, your dance, your celebration. This is right time for Sardar Gurdayal Singh. Put on the light. Old Miss Crumb Bum, the Jehovah's Witness, is going round from door to door collecting money to send missionaries abroad. She knocks on the door of Hamish McTavish, the Scotsman, and when Hamish opens the door, she starts her speech. Praise the Lord, good sir, intones Miss Crumbum. We are planning to send 20 witnesses of Jehovah to the African countries. Please give generously for our missionary service overseas. Absolutely not, replies Hemis. I totally disapprove of those foreign missions. But good sir, cries Miss Crumbum, the scriptures command us to feed the hungry. Well, that's fine, says Hemis, but surely we can feed them on something cheaper than missionaries. The new priest in the village, young Father Fever, is coming to visit the side-bottom household. So little Sally's mother gives her daughter some instructions. If the new priest asks you your name, says Mrs. Sidebottom, say Sally Jane. And if he asks you how old you are, say you are 7 years old. And if he asks who made you, say God made me. Can you remember all that? I think so, says Sally. A few minutes later, young Father Fever arrives, puts down his hat and his Bible, and walks up to little Sally. He pats her on the head and says, I am Father Fever, your new priest. And what is your name, little girl? Sally Jane, replies Sally. And how old are you, Sally Jane? Asks the priest. 7 years old, replies Sally. Well, that is nice, says Fever. And do you know who made you, Sally Jane? Little Sally hesitates for a moment and then says, shit, Mom did tell me, but I have forgotten the guy's name. Late one evening on the little Greek island of Crete, old Mrs. Lilipopolis is weeping into her black handkerchief, mourning the recent death of her old friend, Mrs. Akipolis. Ah, wails old Mrs. Lilipopolis to Bishop Cretin, who is holding her hand. God is so unjust. He is knocking off us old ladies one by one. I must say, Bishop Cretin, that my faith in the Blessed Bleeding Virgin is beginning to wobble. Don't worry, my child, comforts Bishop Cretin impatiently. You are only 97 years old. You have lots of life in you still. Just pray to God Almighty and everything will be fine. But over the next few days, old Mrs. Lilipopolis gets freaked out. She starts looking around for something else to strengthen her faith. One night she is wandering the streets of the village and finds herself in Madame Gogol's fortune-telling parlor. I have been a Blessed Bleeding Virgin Christian all my life, says old Mrs. Lilipopolis, and you are a spiritualist and a pagan. But I have come to you because I have lost faith in Bishop Cretin. I come to you in the hope of receiving the answer to one question. Madame Gogol nods her head and closes her eyes. Lapsing into a deep trance, go ahead, she says, in a spiritual voice. Tell me your question. I want to know, says old lady Lilipopolis, when I die, will I go to heaven? I mean my Christian heaven, to be reunited with my friends, Mrs. Soufalaki, Mrs. Theocrepolis, and Mrs. A. Kiprolis in the glory of eternal paradise. After some time, in a deep trance, Madame Gogol opens her eyes and speaks, "I have asked the sacred ones if you will go to heaven," moans Madame Gogol, "and their answer is, and the old fortune teller rubs her thumb and forefinger under the old Greek woman's nose. "Ah, yes," cries old Mrs. Lillipopolis, fumbling in her purse and bringing out a handful of money. She puts it on the table, and then Madame Gogol continues, "Well, there is some good news and some bad news. First, the good news. Yes, Mrs. Lillipopolis, because you have been such a good person, you will be transported by the heavenly angels to paradise, to the golden throne in the skies, and there you will remain throughout eternity with all the other blessed virgins sitting on God's knee." "Ah," cries old Mrs. Lillipolis, "ah, I am completely overwhelmed." "Wait," continues Madame Gogol, "and the bad news is," but Madame Gogol interrupts the old lady, "after such wonderful good news, what news could possibly be bad?" "Well," says Madame Gogol, "you will be going there tonight." Close your eyes and feel your body to be completely frozen. This is the right moment to enter in your inner world. You have to reach just below your navel, 2 inches exactly below, inside. Gather your energy and total consciousness and rush with a deep urgency, as if this is going to be your last moment on the earth. Only those who have such urgency and intensity ever reach to their center of life. Faster and faster, deeper and deeper. As you are coming closer to your center, a great silence descends over you, just like soft rain falling. You can feel the coolness. A little more closer, and you find an explosion of light. Your inner world becomes luminous. A little more deeper, and flowers of blissfulness, flowers of ecstasy, suddenly start showering on you.
existence is rejoicing in your inner journey. This is the only spiritual pilgrimage. Just one step more and you are standing at the very center of your being. This is the state of a Gautam Buddha. The space of all the Buddhas. At this moment, you are no more. Only the Buddha is. And the Buddha has only one quality, witnessing. Witness that you are not the body. Witness that you are not the mind. And witness that you are only the witness. This pure witnessing opens all the closed doors of existence and life, of song and dance, of the ultimate celebration of becoming one with the cosmos. To make this witnessing deeper, Nivedana, relax. This is your original face. We in the East have symbolized Gautam Buddha's face as everybody's original face. That is only a symbol. Recognize it and rejoice in its recognition. At this moment, you are the most blessed people on the earth. Everybody is concerned with the trivia. You are trying to explore the very center of life and existence. Other than this, there is no religiousness. Other than this, there is no spirituality. And this experience is absolutely individual. It has nothing to do with the collective, with the society, with an organized religion. And from this opening, you can see there is no God, there is only godliness surrounding you, all around, limitless. The height is infinite, the depth is infinite, but you don't find any God anywhere. On the contrary, you start melting and disappearing. Gautam the Buddha auditorium has become an ocean of consciousness. 10,000 Buddhas have joined together into one consciousness. This is your truth. And this is the beauty of the truth. And this is the divineness of the truth. One who knows this center And this opening into existence knows all. Collect as many flowers as you can of serenity, of tranquility, of silence, of peace, of ecstasy, of a divine drunkenness. You have to bring all these juices of life from the center to the surface of your day-to-day life. You have to start living like a Buddha, with the same grace, with the same beauty, with the same truth, with the same authenticity, with the same originality. This opening and the experience of it will bring you a dignity which is not ego, a pride which is not ego, but simply a joy, simply a remembrance that you are existential, not accidental. Hence the possibility of celebration. The accidental person lives in anguish, in anxiety, in angst. The existential person lives in celebration, in love, in grace, in gratitude. Do not forget to persuade the Buddha to come with you. These are the three steps of enlightenment. The first step, Buddha comes behind you as a shadow, but the shadow is luminous. It has tremendous warmth and it surrounds you with a new fragrance, fragrance of the beyond. The next step, second step, you become the shadow, Buddha comes in front of you. Your shadow goes on becoming thinner and thinner as Buddha becomes more and more solid and existential. A moment comes, and the third step happens on its own accord. Your shadow has disappeared. You are no more. Only the Buddha is. Only the life is. Only the existence is. Hence the celebration. Nivedana, come back. But come with all the glory and the splendor of a Buddha, with all the grace and silence and peace, and sit down just for a few seconds to remind yourself of the golden path that you have followed and the depth you have reached within yourself. And all the experiences, and feel the presence of Buddha behind you. The day is not far away when the first step will turn into second step, and the second step will turn into third step. You will be no more. And when you are no more, there is dance,
there is sound, there is joy, there is celebration of life. I celebrate myself and I teach you nothing else but celebration. Religiousness has fallen into wrong hands and they have made the whole world sad and miserable. I want the world to be filled with laughter, with joy, with festivity. The whole life, moment to moment, has to be lived as a celebration. That is the only religious life. And you have the every potential and every opportunity. Just a little relaxed, effortless, melting into the ocean that surrounds you, and the dance begins, and the dance never ends. Okay, Manisha?
Yes, beloved Master.